Tonight will be Dan H. from Los Gatos.
Hello, my name's Dan, and I'm an alcoholic. And to set things straight, I've been told that I'm going to speak for 15 minutes, not 45 minutes, and I'm glad of that today. I can say right off the bat, it's like today's been one of those days that I am glad I'm sober, because if I wasn't, I'd definitely be drunk. You know, it's one of these things where it's like, it sounds really profound, you know, but it's true. It's like, what's going on in my life and all the things that are happening, it's that way, you know. I'm totally grateful to God and Alcoholics Anonymous for being sober today. You know, it is definitely from the grace of God. Little background on my story is that, that thing sounds loud, is that I was born and raised in Los Gatos, and I drank and used in Los Gatos and a couple other little cities around this area, like Santa Cruz and Campbell and wherever else I could do stuff and rip and roar. And, I don't know, I started drinking at age 8, I think it was. I got drunk at a wedding, and so about age 22, I drank and used drugs and did all sorts of other crazy shit until it didn't work anymore. And that's the bottom line, you know. I'm one of these types of alcoholics I truly believe. Come on in. I truly believe that if I could drink and use like a regular person, I would. You know, I'm not one of these ones that says, oh, wow, I would go without it if I could, you know. I'm not that spiritually well, I guess would be the way of saying it. Anyway, 15 minutes, huh? Exactly, I know. Long story short is that in 1986, I was brought to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous by a guy named Ed Kamal, and he's still around. And then when I arrived, the guy who's speaking after me was here, and a couple people who are in this room right now were there, but, you know, that's about it. And it's an interesting kind of thing to know. But my life had completely stopped working, you know, is what I can say. On the outside, I looked just about the same as I look now. Maybe I looked a little better because I had that big image going on, like I look hip, slick, and cool. And, you know, I had like the traditional 4-inch ponytail and long blonde hair and acted like a surfer. And now, like today, I've got really short hair. I look like an All-American, and I probably surf better than ever, you know, if that has anything to do with it. My drinking and drug use was that I'm the freeze-dried variety. I mean, it's like the first time I drank to get drunk. People who drink sociably, I don't understand. I never have, and I don't think I ever will. You know, I call myself an alcoholic, and even though I am an alcoholic and a drug addict, and I have other stories to say, because the analogy that was best put it was, alcohol was an appetizer at a party, and then would come the main course would be drugs. But the thing is that, like at many parties I went to with food, is that if there was no main course, I could survive on appetizers. And I could just drink and drink and drink and get drunk and take care of my needs and act out. And it worked for a while. And then I got the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't understand it. You know, if you're new here, welcome. Definitely congratulations on staying dry, you know. But the thing is, this is about sobriety. And I found out sobriety for me is a completely different thing than not drinking. I found that not drinking is not a sufficient substitute for drinking for me. And that drinking did a lot of miraculous stuff. It took away my pain. It made me feel big and strong. It made my insecurities go away. And not drinking just left me with a bunch of screwed up emotional problems, and I was just left with a bunch of nerves, and I didn't know how to act like a human being. And through the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps, I've learned to be sober, you know, even when times are hard. You know, my story goes that I had 40 days of sobriety here in San Jose, basically going to Saturday Night Live, and had worked my third step, and I moved to Santa Barbara. I went to UC Santa Barbara, and the town next to it is Isla Vista, which is just a crazy drunken college town. And if you've been down there, you know what I'm talking about. If you've been to any drunken college town, you know what I'm talking about. And they're all the same. You can go to Chico or San Diego or wherever you want to go, and they're all there. You know, drunks are everywhere. We're everywhere. Anyway, what happens is I didn't drink for a while down there, but I wasn't going to meetings. I wasn't doing anything like that. And I started going really nuts. And my roommate, who happened to be a coke dealer, which is really kind of crazy, I told him this Friday night, it's like, I'm going to go out and drink. It was around this time of year, too. I was like, I'm going to go out and drink, or I'm going to go to an AA meeting. And, you know, this is like the grace of God working in my life. He decided that it was better for me to be sober than to be drunk, you know, the coke dealer. And he decided to call central office for me, get the address of a meeting, and hand it to me and said, I prefer you to be sober than drunk. And I went to this meeting. It was like the schooner group, and everybody there was like 55 and above, you know, and like they had all like, you know, we'd spilt more than you drank, kitty, you know, kind of attitude. And I was like, oh, God, I'm condemned, you know, to a boring, glum life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the end of the meeting, they said, you know what, the young people meet tomorrow at this location. This is where you should probably go. And I went the next day, and it was like I saw people that, you know, the average age was probably about, I don't know, 22, 23 years old. And I fell into a group of about 20 college students who were all staying sober. You know, we had meetings on campus, and I had meetings in town, and that's where I met my first sponsor, and my second sponsor, I should say. My second sponsor's sponsor was this guy named Mark, and Mark was a big, tough kind of, we're going to work the steps or die, you puke, you know, kind of guy. And his sponsor was a guy named Clancy, and if you've been around here long enough, you'll know who Clancy is, you know, and it's part of the Pacific Group, and it was like, you're going to get a commitment, and you're going to work the steps, and you're going to do this thing, or you're going to get your ass out of our way because we ain't got time for people like you. And the fact of the matter is that if you don't do this stuff, you're going to die. And, like, I was scared into sobriety. I mean, it was like, if you don't do these things, you're going to die. And it's like, I truly believe that to my innermost self, that if I do not stay sober, I'm going to die. And the fact of the matter is I probably won't die tomorrow. I'll probably die some long alcoholic death where I just look like this a miserable being and I take down everybody else with me. You know, and it's like, I don't want to die that way. And so I was scared into sobriety. It was like I got in with a group of people where it was like, what step are you on? You know, I'm doing my third step. I'm doing my fourth step. You know, this is where I'm at. And it was like a kind of a challenge. It was like a group challenge. Like, where are you at? What is your commitment? Where are you going? You know, what's happening? And like my whole life revolved around that. I mean, academically, I did worse in school. I mean, I was one of these overachiever types. So I did really well in school. And when I got sober, like they told me, it doesn't matter what your grades are. If you're drunk, you're dead. And I'm like, okay, I'll go to the meeting to set up chairs and clean up ashtrays and do all these things. And I stayed sober. And it was a miracle. You know, and like within my first year, I worked all the steps. You know, and like I didn't even think I had anything really to offer anybody. And that second year, I got my first sponsee. And within 2 weeks, they drank. And I felt like hell. And there was this guy named Mark Kay, who most of you know. You know, who I went up to him, I go, oh, Mark, this guy drank, and I feel so good. And he's like, are you sober? Yeah, then don't worry about it. You know, and that was the course of it. You know, I learned through the rigors of it. And, you know, that's I got a little wine. Okay. That's the way it worked. You know, and what I can say is that by working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, my life began to change. And change in ways that I couldn't even imagine. You know, like one of the first miraculous things that happened is that I graduated from college, you know, and it's like I graduated from college with a degree I didn't particularly like. When I was three quarters of the way through it, I got really resentful at the fact that I'd studied this subject for a long time, and I was pissed. I mean, I have a degree in mathematics, and I don't particularly like mathematics. I'm just good at it, you know, and that I did it for attention, and so I got to thinking that screw this, I'm going to study fine arts and do ceramics. And my sponsor was a straight enough guy who basically said, no, you're not. What you're going to do is you're going to finish your degree in mathematics because a degree in mathematics is worth something. Three quarters of a degree in mathematics ain't worth shit. You know, and you're going to, you know, do it. And it's like, okay. And so I took direction like that. You know, my biggest suggestion to people who are new in Alcoholics Anonymous, even if you're old, you know, honesty, open-minded, and willingness. That saves my butt on a regular basis. You know, I graduated from college. I went overseas, and I taught English in Japan for a year. And that was a pretty incredible experience. And I was in a little village in southern Japan where there were no AA meetings. There wasn't hardly anybody who was even speaking English. You know, I'd go months without seeing other Caucasians, you know, let alone anybody else of any color. And it was wild. And I hung out with some Buddhist priests and learned to meditate and hang out with them and increase my spirituality. You know, and worked the steps to the best of my ability. I listened to crazy tapes by this guy named Bobby Earle, and what I ended up doing was, like, when I was really nuts, I'd put a chair in the middle of the room, and I'd have a meeting by myself and have the different parts of my brain that was acting out, like the little overachiever and then the irate kid and the pissed off alcoholic. And I'd have these meetings and have topics and just do it. You know, it sounds totally insane, but you know what? It worked. I didn't drink, you know. And that, you know, I spent a year abroad. I came back and it was like I got some kind of Joe job. You know, I went out there in the valley and got a job and had to go put in 40 hours a week. And next thing I know, it's kind of like I got promoted and I was at the same job for 4 years. You know, and it's like at times I hated the job, you know, and I went and showed up and, you know, got new sponsors and did my work, my steps with them, you know, and be quite honest, you know, it's like I've had stuff fall out with sponsors. I've had to fire my sponsor and say this guy didn't work for me and because I don't trust him any longer and find a new sponsor. So, you know, if you're having trouble with that, get yourself another one. Just make sure, I was taught just for me to clean up my side of the street, you know, to always clean up my side of the street. That's what I'm held accountable for. And, God, I need to hear myself talking more than I need to talk to you guys. And, shit. It's interesting. That whole experience. But, anyway, is that just recently to kind of get up to speed is that in January of this year, I left to Central America. I spent basically three months out in the jungles of Costa Rica teaching English or attempting to teach English to people who wanted to learn, but it happened to be that they're illiterate in Spanish language, and so being illiterate in their mother tongue, they weren't really going to learn English too well. And it was such a remote place that the common things for people to do was like, let's go get fermented. I mean, the men was like, let's go get drunk and beat our wives, or let's go get drunk and sleep with someone else's wife. And after being there for a while, you know, neither one of those is acceptable behavior for me. So I had to basically kind of say, I think I'm out of here. You know, I tried to get a hold of my support organization, and they weren't there. And so I was basically out in the jungles of Costa Rica, you know, going, God, please help me. And I'll tell you this, when you pray for God's help in a situation and it continues to get worse, my experience is that's God's way of telling you it's time to leave. You know, it's that simple. You know, God doesn't come down and do a lightning bolt kind of stuff. It was really straightforward. And so I left back and I came back home. And that was a worthwhile experience because A, I went for a dream, and B, when it got too crazy, I had enough sense to come home to the people that love me. You know, my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I have found a group of individuals who I can act out in the most insane behaviors and do whatever I particularly want within the realms of me cleaning up my side of the street when I'm done and be able to live life. You know, that's the bottom line. You know, just recently, I've had some awarenesses come to find out with other behavior that I've got that kept me from, you know, leading a spiritual life. You know, is that I have other issues in my life that my family of origin, you know, like the idea of your family of origin gives you tools. My family of origin gave me some tools, and it was like the two tools I've got was major ones were let's get drunk and get violent. That was from my dad, and my mother's tools were like just stuff it down low enough and it'll go away. You know, and it's like neither one of those worked for me. And so what I'm left with in Alcoholics Anonymous is the 12 steps of the tools of how to live. You know, and once again, I found out there's an old behavior pattern that basically has to do with intimacy with other human beings. That it's like, I didn't get that part. You know, and it's like I'm powerless over it, and it interferes with all my relationships, and it makes my life unmanageable. You know, and I came to believe that a power greater than myself can start restoring me to sanity. You know, and later on tonight, I'll probably have a pen in my paper and start doing an inventory behind that subject. I'm going to probably share it this week with my sponsor, you know, and then I'm going to keep on doing what his advice is and keep working that kind of stuff because that's what works in my life today. You know, it's like long-term, you know, only prerequisite for long-term sobriety I find is not drinking, you know, and not dying. That's about it, you know, and the people who walked before me told me that same thing. And I've had a lot of crazy stuff happen to me, but you know what? I haven't had to drink today, and that is incredibly wonderful. You know, it's like I know today into my innermost self that I've got a choice to drink or not to drink. And I choose not to drink today. And that is I didn't have that choice before. I had to drink. I had to drink and I had to use drugs because those are my coping mechanisms for life. And I found out that the 12 steps offers me a way out. And of course, you know, I was just reading some literature. It's something called a Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's something else written by neither Bob nor Bill. And I suggest you read it if you haven't read it yet. And that it talks about that at one point it says, you know, of course, like most alcoholics who are neurotic, which I am, it's like, I want one solution for all my problems. Like, if I just say this certain little prayer, you know, or do this certain little step, then it's all going to come better. And that doesn't always work. You know, I found out that I've had to search. You know, and I've had to pick up ideas and put down ideas and learn new ways and let go of old ways. But I don't drink. You know, and if that's a miracle, I think it's immeasurable. You know, the other big thing that I can basically say about Alcoholics Anonymous is that I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous my life is based on my actions and not my thoughts. You know, that I am an alcoholic and that people judge me by my actions. And like working with other alcoholics, showing up here, you know, doing what I've been told and taking the footsteps that's required and advised by others, my life seems to get better. Because when I sat in my room, my little pipe, my little, you know, bong and all those other kind of stuff that I had in my room, you know, I just sat in my room and thought about the universe and didn't do shit. You know, and it's like the fact of the matter is that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a way of life that I can live and I can be a participant to society. You know, it's like I laugh and when I look at myself in the mirror because I have this like totally military short kind of haircut. I look like a G.I. Joe kind of guy. And it makes me laugh because it's like that's not who came into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that's just for me a showing of willingness. It's like today I want to get a job and part of that is like I'm willing to cut my hair and look like this kind of thing to sell myself as a package. Because you know what? I found out that my exterior isn't really who I am. You know, I've got a spirit inside of me and that's basically who I think I am. And that a spirit's attached to God, as I understand it. And so when I try and find a spiritual solution to most of my problems, I seem to find peace of mind. And that's about enough out of me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. Our main speaker tonight is John C. from Las Gatas.
My name is John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
I enjoyed your talk. I declared myself as an alcoholic. I happen to have been one of those people who gathered any and all information I have about the disease of alcoholism by coming here. Prior to coming here, I drank alcohol, and the concept of whether or not I was an alcoholic never entered my mind. Now, it may have entered the minds of a lot of the people around me, but never me. I am blessed. I have been blessed since the moment I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to this very second. I did not come here out of my own volition, nor did I come out of here out of knowledge of the disease of alcoholism or because my wife or the courts or anything else. I came here, I thought on an accident. I came here because one night it happened to be on a Thursday night, the 11th of March, and it happened to be, the year was 1976, a young man came to a saloon where I was, drinking, of course, Jack Daniels with just a splash of soda, and enjoying myself as I always thought I was doing. And he sat down beside me and started drinking Coke, and told me about a place he had come to called Alcoholics Anonymous. And he wanted to take me there. I thought he was insane. I wanted to throw him out. And when he asked me to come to my first meeting or come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, instead of telling him what I thought, I said yes. And I was stunned. And I was trapped by my own words. Because I considered myself a man of his word, and I agreed to come to an AA meeting, and so I was condemned to come here. I had no idea what happened to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea what kind of people I would see, and so I came here. My first meeting on, and this is kind of like it has been for me since I have been here. I came to my first meeting on a Tuesday night. I was 4 days without taking anything, and I found the people insensitive. I found themselves crude. They talked and shared disgusting, filthy, loathsome things about themselves, and people laughed. And I thought it was just absolutely, just dreadful. People should behave that way. They had the courtesy of calling on me in that meeting, and my contribution to society and Alcoholics Anonymous that night was, I'm here to see what the creeps do on Tuesday night. And that's the best offer I could have. I was so incensed with this group that I would have left had I been in my own car, but I was too damn unwilling to walk home because I rode in my friend's car. He brought me to that meeting. But I was curious, nevertheless. I heard somebody in that first meeting say something that got to me just a little bit. He said that you would never have to drink again as long as you live if you didn't want to. Now, the concept of not drinking and forever just escaped my mind whatsoever. What triggered my mind that night was the man said, you'll never have to drink. And since I was generally had to admit that I related to an awful lot of the things that people said when they were talking about their drinking, the concept that I had been drinking for the 30 years that I drank because I had to really devastated me. I bought a book that night. I went home with my friend and told my wife that basically I was an alcoholic. And she said, oh, wow, just wonderful. We've got a name to call you. You're not a jackass. You're an alcoholic. She had this weird conception that I would never drink again. I don't know where she got the idea. She sure as hell never got it from me. Because I didn't know that if you understand the disease of alcoholism, and you truly understand the disease of alcoholism, the definition is that alcoholics, as far as I'm concerned, cannot safely drink. And I've lost the ability to control my drinking, and that if I if I call myself an alcoholic, I'm condemned to do one of two things. Seek recovery or go on to the bitter end, as our book talks about, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation as best I can. I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. My friend took me to a meeting on the following Friday night in his car again. I found the people different, thank God. They were just a little better, but they still were insensitive and a little crude. My friend had asked me to go to a meeting the following Tuesday night, and I came to that same meeting to see how these slobs were, and I found a remarkable improvement in just 1 week. It's amazing how much better those people got in a one-week period of time. I went to my fourth meeting on a third Friday night with my friend back to this other place, and I fell in love that night. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell in love with a way of life. Something happened inside of me. I just absolutely fell in love. Fell in love, and I asked my friend, called my friend up and asked him to come to a meeting on Saturday, and he didn't want to come, and I came to my first meeting alone. And as I say, as each day has gone by, I'm deeper and deeper in love with the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm intrigued by the people I meet, and I am just absolutely overwhelmed with recovery. From the moment I walked into the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that Tuesday night on March, which happened to be March the 16th of 1976, from that second to this, the quality of my life has gotten better. The inside of my life has gotten better. See, I drank because I had a number of reasons by drinking. But one of the reasons that I drank, or the one of the excuses that I had, is that I couldn't stand what went on inside my head. Many times in those last years, I would go home and I would drink, or I would drink after work, but I would drink as much just in order to be able to go to sleep, because I couldn't stand this god-awful brain that was just going off and wanting to explode. The cry of the alcoholic, the one who just absolutely just rehashing and trying to go through the life that I had lived and trying to solve all of the problems that I could never solve. And I was just absolutely desperate. I married the lady that I was married to. It started out so magnificently. And by the time I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, what I thought was one of the great love affairs turned into an endurance contest. You see, I like to tell you that I basically feel that I learned this about the disease of alcoholism. I took my first drink somewhere in the middle of March of 1946 in El Paso, Texas, in the Green Frog. And I liked what happened to me that night. I drank the same way that night that I did the last night I drank. Well, not the last drunk I had. As I drank with both hands, I drank as much as I could get until I couldn't drink anymore. And I either passed out, blacked out, or woke up the next day. And people told me I had a wonderful time. That's the way I drank the first time, and that's the way I finished with my last drunk. And I can tell you, the great intelligence of the alcoholic is that I genuinely believe that I probably spent 30 years gathering in useless information, because everything I needed, I learned the first night, that I could not control my drinking, and I got in trouble when I drank, generally speaking, and I was not happy with myself. There are those of you who can claim, and very righteously claim, that you had a wonderful time drinking. I was a lousy drunk. I don't know about you. I was just a lousy drunk. I was never satisfied with drinking. The best I can give you is I had 2 years of good drinking. That is, I thought I was a hero, and I thought I was a badass, and I looked to find a lot of problems, and I could go into all kinds of saloons, and I just had a wonderful time being a John Wayne two-fisted drinker and a two-fisted fighter, and just having a wonderful time. You know, I used to as a professional boxer at one time, and I had to quit that because it interfered with my drinking. And the way I started drinking was in Washington, D.C. I was in the Army at the time, and I had a 3-day pass. Now, I always had a 3-day pass, a Class A pass, and I guess I was on 4 and off 3. We were working for what it was called the Army Security Agency, but that was a long time before it became the Army Security Agency. This is before most of you were born. That was then just a branch of G2, and I was learning how to become a radio intercept operator. But what I would do is that I would, 4 days working my little fanny off, I'd go into D.C., and I'd go right on Skid Row, because I thought it was exciting, and I didn't have to worry about paying any money for anything other than booze, because I could panhandle with the boys, and I could sleep in the streets, and I could find the good life of sleeping with the drunks out on the street, and I thought it was a good thing. I found a bourbon whiskey in El Paso, Texas, and I drank it as much as I could. I spent 10 years drinking bourbon whiskey. It took me 10 years to learn how to put a little ice in it. So, because I was always striving to be a better and better drunk, and then it took me 10 years to learn how to put just a splash of soda in the damn thing so that I can control and enjoy my drinking. So my final drink was Jack Daniels over with a splash of 7, and I had finally arrived. And that's the way I drank. But I had, as I said, 2 years of good drinking, and I went up and down the coast in the state of California after I got out of the Army, just having a wonderful time. Until an accident happened in the streets of Los Angeles that made it impossible for me to do the fighting that I used. It appeared in a fight that somebody got hurt very dreadfully and ultimately died. And from that second to this, I've never hit anybody as long. And that's a long time when you're a mad, crazy, foolish alcoholic who prides himself on being a very, very, very tough man. In addition to which, I married my high school sweetheart, and she delivered unto us a wonderful little baby girl. And I realized that the kind of life that I was living, this macho, wonderful, John Wayne type two-fisted drinking life, had to change, and I became a businessman because I wanted to take care of my wife and my little girl. And so my drinking career changed dramatically then, because then I became a businessman and was very successful in that. 11 years later, I had turned into a periodic drunk. The more successful I was, the more I drank. And I was coming off of a running drunk one evening, and woke up talking on the telephone to find that my first wife had committed suicide. She couldn't stand the pace of the life that I was living. And I had 5 little girls, and I went absolutely mad. And I woke up in the psychiatric wing of the Los Angeles General Hospital in a straitjacket. It took me a while to get out of that place. And I came and I grabbed, when I got out of that place, I brought my children up to Northern California because I was unemployable in Southern California. And nobody would hire me down there because of my reputation, although I had enjoyed great success. It was a closed construction industry. It was a closed corporation, you might say. And I came to Northern California because it's the only job I could get. And my drinking changed dramatically. Once again, nobody had ever said, even in the nut house, nobody said, John, you should learn how to drink differently. Nobody ever told me that there was a problem with alcohol. I didn't know the first 2 years of my life, first 2 years of drinking, nor did I know it in the next 11. I just came to Northern California and changed. From when I was a single parent, I went a year without drinking anything. Not because I was trying to stop drinking. It never even entered my mind. I didn't have any money. And besides, if you're become a single parent with five little girls, and you're used to brag to the effect that you've never even changed a diaper, if you can imagine that. I had five little girls and I'd never changed a diaper in my life. I used to brag that I couldn't even boil water without burning it. But by the time I got to Northern California, I got pretty good. Learning how to cook, learning how to iron, and man, it was cool. I was really good. I became a good father, and I became a good husband, or a father, and a parent, and I learned how to cook and iron. Just had a wonderful time working in South San Francisco at the time when I lived in San Mateo. But then I started drinking again because I started becoming successful, and I remember one night, one of the first nights I started drinking while I was a single parent, and I was ironing. There's some ladies in this room. If you iron, I listened to my mother talk about ironing, and she said it had to stand in front of an iron, and how dreadful it was. So I learned how to iron sitting down because I wasn't going to stand up. And if you learn how to iron sitting down, for God's sake, you're going to have to learn how to do it left and right handed because it doesn't work otherwise. And back in those days, and this is long before wash and wear. And so all of my little girls had these fancy, beautiful little dresses. And my oldest daughter had a beautiful peasant dress. It was all white lace, white yoke and white lace and puff sleeves and all white lace down here. And it was brown underlayer, and it was just a beautiful dress. And I was drinking Jack Daniels and ironing while the kids were all asleep. And while I had a drink, I scorched the lace. And I spent an hour and a half in the rest of Jack Daniels scorching all the rest of the lace to match. A beautiful brown dress. A little snot. She never wore it. I could never figure that out. She never wore it again. I met a lady then and fell in love with her and. And one of the great successes of my life is the woman that I met. I claim that it's the greatest thing that has ever happened to her. She is a born Al-Anon. She was actually born to be an Al-Anon. And I came into her life and fulfilled it and because she needed an alcoholic. She was born Al-Anon waiting for an alcoholic to happen, and I came into her and life, and she happened to be. The ladies will enjoy this. She was 26 years old. She had a boy and a girl. And one night, at age 26, she had seven kids. And that makes her an Al-Anon. You've got to believe that. And a husband who happened to be a drunk. I remember telling her, honey, stick with me. I'll take you places you've never gone. I'll show you things you've never seen, and we'll go places you've never gone. I was a division manager of the window company in Northern California at that time. And for the next 15 half years, we made less money every year, went up and down the state of California. And 9 years before I got here, I had failed again. Once again, I changed my drinking career so many different times, but 9 years before I got here, I destroyed everything again. I was a total failure, and I realized that all I could do is live long enough to give my kids a fair start in life. By the time I got here into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was with a successful company here in San Jose. The boss and I used to go out and drink all the time. I don't know how many times we would say, let's go down, have one drink, and we'd go there and close the bar. I would either get fired or promoted. I would quit. But it was always the same. And when it was all done, we had the damnedest fights and the wonderful time. And I would go home with my group of friends, and I would get in the swimming pool and do my elementary backstroke, and just having a wonderful time with all my friends. And my wife and my children would look out the window and see that I was the only one in the pool. I was just like a fool, splashing up and down there, hoping I'm going to drown. I had the biggest parties there all alone, because that's the way it was for me. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, wonderful things happened. You see, I had always believed that I was born to do something. You know, Bill Wilson talks about those dreams of vainglory. I had a little dream when I was a little boy. And the little dream, you see, I came from, as most of us come from, an alcoholic home. I don't know. I know that had nothing to do with it. But I remember the times that my father, I was quite like my father. My father died, by the way, of the disease of alcoholism at age 55, although I did not know that at the time. As a matter of fact, being my last name is Carney, the Carney clan, for seven generations, that's as far as they've tracked it back. No male has ever lived past 55. It's this disease, this family disease, that certainly is inherited, because no male has ever lived past the age of 55 in my family. I've lost two brothers and a father, and God knows how many of predecessors of my grandfather and on the Kearney side, and I go back through there. And they all died from either war accidents or the disease of alcoholism. So here I am, and I've fallen in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wanted this thing, and I didn't know how to interface very well with you people, and I started studying the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because our speaker before was talking about the importance of the 12 steps of recovery. See, I learned about the disease of alcoholism, and I learned about this thing, and I realized that in order to have the way of life that you were talking about, there are things that I must do. Now, you see, I've spent some time between drinks. As a periodic, you do that. My drinking is just kind of like this. I drank as long as I could, as hard as I could, and drank as much as I could, as long as I could, and then I stayed sober as long as I could stay sober. But I can tell you that staying sober is infinitely tougher and meaner, and I was a rotten, miserable person when I was between drinks. The longer I was between drinks, the worse I felt, and the tougher life was. So that's why I had to drink. I had to drink in order to get rid of the life experiences. So this business, yes, you can stay and have long-term sobriety. Or you can live and stay sober forever, for God's sake. Just don't drink and stay alive. But oh my God, what kind of a life is that? It's a book tells me. We find that the alcoholic is unthinking who says sobriety is enough. He's like the man coming out of the cellar after that huge tornado and saying, "Look, Ma, isn't it grand? I'm not drinking anymore." No, no, no. It's got to be more than that. I couldn't conceive of a life that did not include my salvation was alcohol. The only thing that kept me alive long enough was alcohol. Now, I didn't know that when I was drinking, for God's sake. Oh, this is the information I've acquired since I have been sober. So I knew, and I'm so delighted and grateful that I got sober with the people that I got sober with, at the time I got sober, where I got sober, because it worked for me. You see, I got involved in the teachings of a wonderful man who happened to be Clancy's sponsor, for God's sake. And I thought he was the greatest, and I still think he's one of the greatest men in my life. He has had more impact on me and probably Alcoholics Anonymous, perhaps, than any one single person other than Bill and Bob. But he taught me a number of things, and he said that one of the things that you alluded to when you were speaking is that I can I can live my way into right thinking, but I cannot think my way into right living. And without any question about it, it means that my actions are, you're going to judge me, and I judge me on my actions. And that's the way it is. So I had to get involved in the 12 steps of recovery. I selected a sponsor. I asked him to be my sponsor. It was the single most toughest thing I've ever done in my entire life. I had to go to somebody and ask for help, recognizing I wanted to do something, and I wanted to do it real bad. It was so vitally important to me, and I had to make myself so vulnerable. It was the toughest thing I've ever done in my entire life, is to ask this man to be my sponsor. Because I needed help. I needed somebody to guide me through the 12 steps of recovery. And so I did, as I said, I started studying the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, going to meetings and doing all of the right things, because I was going to judge myself by my actions. I was going to start living my way into right thinking. And in the process of doing that, I did in true fact understand the nature of my disease, that I have a physical allergy coupled by an obsession of the mind, and that I am condemned to drink. If I be alcoholic, I'm condemned to drink. By myself, I am condemned to drink and die. And by myself, I cannot live without drinking. So I have to have a substitute for that. And our book talks about that. And vastly more than that, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the very thing that I fell in love with, the fellowship of the Spirit, that's what I fell in love with. And of course, the way of life that was offered. And as a direct result of that, I started working these 12 steps. You know, and I looked at the 12 steps, and there was nothing I was unwilling to do, but there were things that I thought I could not do. You know, when I looking at my third step, it never entered my mind that I would be able to find a God of my very own. You see, because I hated me, and I hated me beyond all expectations. I didn't want anything to do with me. I didn't like any part of me. I hated everything that I stood for and everything that I was. And I was constitutionally incapable of living without hurting the very and destroying the very things that I'd loved. I'd already destroyed two people, for God's sake, in my own mind. I had destroyed this fabulous marriage. These children that I adored were all running away from me and afraid of me. And I didn't know why. So in the process of taking understanding, I got to really get in depth in recognizing in a moment of clarity the destruction and the havoc that occurred by my drinking. And I realized that in true fact, I was powerless over alcohol. It's the first time I kind of did at best inventory I was capable. I admitted to the problem that I was powerless over alcohol. And God knows the evidence indicated my life had become unmanageable. And that's the problem. And there is nothing but the problem in the problem. There has to be a solution to the problem. And the solution, as I understand it, comes one of the acceptance that there is a power greater than myself that can and will restore me to sanity. There has to be a solution to the problem. Otherwise, I must drink until I die. There has to be a solution to this thing, and that's the solution, a power that is going to come into my life in some fashion. I have to accept that because that's the solution. I borrowed it from you. You said that's the solution. So I had to borrow it. And said, then if this is the problem, there has to be another. Everybody talks about in heaven and hell. There has to be one or the other. There has to be another. Or I'm condemned, as I say, and to drink until I die. And I cannot live. I cannot live this way anymore. So I accepted the fact that there had to be a power. A power of my own choosing. And so I sat down one day to figure out what kind of a power I was going to have. You see, because I had to find a power. I objected, Bill Wilson wrote in his book, a line that I find that was very important to me. He said to Christ he conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him. And that's the way I thought about the religious people. You see, I thought perhaps there is a Christ or a power, but the religious people sucked, and I hated them all. And so I condemned any and all form of religion. It's just that simple. So then I realized that this had nothing to do with a religion. I have never had a problem with God. I have always had a problem with the way people told me I should believe in Him. And you, for the first time, told me I could choose my own conception of God. And what a freedom that was. So I chose my own conception of God, and I chose it on the basis of the information I had. And the information I had is the fact that there is one prayer that I prayed when I got here that I didn't have any problem with. And it's the only prayer I've never had any problem with. And it starts with Our Father. Now, I don't know why I had it, but I didn't. And so I took that information, and it's a prayer that was acceptable to me. Now, you look wonderful. Just wonderful. I was talking about heaven and hell. There you go. Oh, well, just absolutely gorgeous. Well, I'll get done in a minute and you can go on with your party. But I started with this business of being a father because, you see, I was a lousy father. I wanted so desperately to be a good one, and I was a lousy father. The evidence indicates that. My children had all run away from me. my oldest son, who, or my youngest son, who I adored, all of my kids, but he, my youngest son, was my last chance to make life work and be a good father. By the time I got sober, he was always hiding in the other room when I got here. And that's a miserable way to live. I taught my children that I love you because I have to. Because I did, thought I had to love them, and I didn't know that I loved people just because I loved them. I didn't know that. And so I thought, what kind of a father would I like to be? What kind of a father would I want to be? What kind of a father did I want to have? And I became aware that I wanted a father that loved unconditionally. And I wanted a father that loved all of them. So I accepted there, first of all, that a father, there is a father of love. Then I wanted a father that was going to be, want the best for me. I wanted somebody that was on my side. I wanted a father that was forgiving, all forgiving. I wanted a father that was ever present. And these are the very basic concepts of a God of my ever own, of my very own, but one of the basic problems that I had. And this is the one that I fight out with anybody that I try to fight out with anybody that I sponsor. You see, the book says that there's but one God. And I'm not it. And if that's the case, and I've got a God that is all loving and all forgiving, then I'm immediately faced with the proposition that I've got to damn well forgive me. Because if I don't, then I'm put myself above God. And already it's not going to work because I don't have a power greater than myself. Because I'm starting to negotiate the terms of this thing and it doesn't work that way. And I had a brutal battle that went on inside of me. Because you see, I had to give up the right to beat me up. I had to give up the right for self-condemnation. I had to give that up. And so when I took my third step, and when I finally did agree, I took my third step. It happened to be in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And I took my wife and my daughter, my little son, and my friend who brought me to my first meeting. And we made a big deal out of it. You don't have to take a third step there. Not necessarily go up to where God is, because God is. I wanted something that was going to be memorable in my mind. Something that I could really, really get into this thing. So we drove around, had a picnic lunch, and I found this wonderful place right on the side of the road. And we went inside, and it was a little glen. And I remember the sunlight streaming through. I remember it so vividly. My friend and his wife sat down on a log. My wife, Peggy, and my son, Daniel, and my daughter, Jackie, was the last two at home. And I stood in a circle, and we knelt. And my wife turned her will and her life over to the care of God as she understood it. My daughter turned her will and her life over to the care of God as she understood God. And I did the same. My little boy pulled on his mommy's hand and said, "Mommy, will you do it for me?" And Peggy turned his life over to the care of God. His will is his business, and he's going to have to do that in his own time, in his own way. And it was a big thing, and I don't have time to tell you some of it. I had a phenomenal little spiritual experience that occurred directly behind that, you know, just to give you some of the, I've had the best of everything since I got sober. My life is full of AA miracles. I know that my son was born, this youngest son was born with some extensive learning disabilities, and he has had special treatment all along. And at the time I got sober, I had 9 months after I got sober, I went stone-ass broke. I couldn't afford the special schooling that my son had to take. And it was 2 weeks after our third step that the teacher called Peggy and my wife and said, asked her to come into the school where Daniel was, my son. And the teacher said, "Something's happened to your little boy. His disability seems to have gone." And she went to the doctor because he's been taking medication. He's on special treatment. And the doctor said, after examining and don't know what happened, but it appears as if it's spontaneous remission. We don't know if it'll come back or not, but your son does no longer have a learning disability. And so he went to a regular school, and that was wonderful. A few years later, he came back with a vengeance. But the difference is, a few years later, I had money, and I had to put him into a very special school, which cost the equivalent of a Stanford education, but it worked. He came out He's not healed in that sense. He still has a learning disability, but it's just one of the little miracles that can occur. I've had the best of everything since I've gotten sober. The marriage that was an endurance contest, that when I got sober, has turned into a thing of beauty. You know, this is the lady that I talk about. I was 2 years sober, and I was in a meeting like this, and my wife was doing the speaking, and I was sitting out there, and Peggy said, here we are, we've turned into the love affair, the real love affair of my life, and to find out that I've been married to the girl that I've always been looking for, and I've been married to her for a long time. By the way, on July 30th of this year, we celebrated our 34th wedding anniversary, and just absolutely awesome. But I was sitting in the meeting, and Peggy was talking, and she said, oh my God, I just remembered something. You know what I used to do. And you know what I used to do, she said. And I'm kind of sitting up on the edge of my chair because I'd like to know what the hell she did too, because I wasn't there a lot of the time. And then she said, you know, she said my husband was puny quite a bit. And when he got sick, when he was drinking, he would pass out on the couch. She said I would go to bed real early, but before I did that, I'd turn off the furnace and open up all the doors and windows. And in the morning, he would wake up and he would be all congested. And in a day or two, he would walk up, he would wind up with pneumonia, and he'd go to the hospital. My friend will recognize the man I used to drink with is in the audience tonight, and the man I used to work for, and he will remember quite the number of times that I would go to the hospital with pneumonia. My wife was trying to kill me. She figured that nobody would nail her little ass, because who had ever heard of anybody killing somebody by pneumonia? But that's the way the deviousness of the alcoholic. It is a wonderful thing. I did a fourth step. I found the exact nature of my wrong. It has not changed. I did a fourth step and I had a huge revelation. I realized that I will never have to live that way again as long as I live if I consistently do a 10-step on a daily basis. I took and shared that with my sponsor. I remember going to my sponsor because it was hot, it was heavy, and I remember I walking into his office one morning, bright and early, because I finished writing my fourth step at around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And I went directly to his office and I said, I got a fifth step. And he says, well, I'm busy. And I said that I'm not. And I sat down. And he said, well, John, I'm really busy. And I said, I'm not. I'm going to wait. And every once in a while, he'd look at me. He said, God damn it, are you still there? And I said, yes, sir. I'm still waiting. And about 4 hours later, he said, oh, come on. And I went to a restaurant and I did my fifth step in a restaurant. You know, this is secret stuff that I'm going to die with. Sit right in the Sherwood Inn. Over there on an Almaden Road, right there by the front door in a booth. People walking through all the time, and I'm giving away all my dreadful secrets. And when I was done with it, I felt such a relief, and Jack told me, my sponsor told me, to go home just like and do just exactly what the book said, and I did. I went home and I carefully reread the first 5 proposals, understood what I was about, and what I was about was to enter into a contract with a God of my very own. By now, this deal that the God had developed into something real and real and passionate in my life, a God of my very own. I was entering into a contract with God in step 6 and 7. That's what I understand. It's very simple, because for the first time I was going to take these defects of character and shortcomings, and I was going to give it to someone who could do an infinitely better job of handling it than I. And this is the way I understand my prayer of 6 and 7. It was so very simple. It says, Father, here they are. You help me and tell me when I'm doing it, and I'll stop. You tell me, and I'll stop. So all I have to do is turn it over to the Father of Light and improve my hearing through prayer and meditation. And I hear. And as a direct result of that, the quality of my life has gotten better. I moved into step 8 and redoubled my efforts and had a list of all the people that I had harmed. And I went out and believed, and I did my 9th step. A loving God was so infinitely good to me that He made it very convenient for Him. He put all of the people in my life directly in my life, and I did make all of my night step amends. And I happen to believe, I am a firm, absolute, irrevocable believer, that everybody is going to do step 9. Everybody. You're going to do it voluntarily or involuntarily, but you're going to do step 9. I think it's an irrevocable law of cause and effect. We're going to clean up our act one way or down, one way or the other. You know? And so I practice, and I have finished my 9th step, and I am free. There's a line that I often quote when I talk about freedom. Our first promise of the 12 promises that is listed in the book is that we will know a new freedom. Freedom. What a beautiful law. What a beautiful, beautiful word that is. I quote somebody that you'll remember when I hear it, when I say it, is that this is what I think of. Free. Free at last. Free at last. Thank God I'm free at last. You see, I have no past, I have no future, and I owe nobody anything. That's freedom. I'm free to go. I'm free to stay. That's freedom. I can verify that. And the reason I can verify that by the diligent efforts that I've made on step 10 and 11 and 12 and my involvement in this 12-step program is that a number of years ago, I had this is the story, and I'll just close with it only, not to terrify you or share, be careful about what you pray or anything else, but this is the story, and this is the validation that I give for free at last. And what a wonderful thing it is. I feel good, and I have felt good for the 18 plus years that I have been sober. I have a sense of impending good that is just absolutely awesome. And it's been with me almost from the first day. But when I decided that it was time to quit smoking, I said it's time to quit smoking, but I wasn't willing to quit. But I knew it was time. And they said, use the 12 steps. And I wasn't willing to, because they said, damn it, I'm not willing. They asked for get prayer, pray for willingness, and I'm not willing to ask for God to give me willingness because I didn't want willingness. And I don't believe in frivolous prayers. I don't believe in that shit. I believe in the straight, you pray for what you're going to get. And so I come up with a perfect prayer, and the perfect prayer was, Father, make it difficult for me to continue to smoke. Just that simple. And from that second to this, I still haven't had a qualm with that. Make it difficult for me to continue to smoke. The following morning, somewhere around 12 o'clock, thereabout, I had a massive heart attack. And they had to haul my little fanny to the hospital. They called 911, and these people picked me up, and they took me there, and they're doing all sorts of frantic things to keep the old man alive. And I was laying on this table, and I'm in more pain than you can possibly imagine. And I hear them say that we've only got one more go at this thing. Let's get it right this time. And then all the pain went away. And I became aware that I'm looking down on me. And I hear them say, wow, too bad. We've lost him. Well, let's keep going. And I realized that I was out of the body and that I had died. And I want to tell you what I felt. Because I'm the same guy that used to couldn't go to sleep at night. I'm the same guy that couldn't stand me or any part of me. Same guy that destroyed everything that was of any value to you, to him. Same guy that was born into a world that he hated, never get along with anybody. First thing I said, hot damn. Wow. Now I'm really going to know. I'm really going to know. Because you see, I believe if you believe in God, dying is a geographic. Now it's a pretty good sized geographic, but nevertheless it's a geographic. If you believe in God, dying is a geographic, and I was a great sense of anticipation and delight and joy. I'm really going to know. And then I suddenly thought, wait a minute. And I looked back at my life, and I looked at my wife, and I looked at my children, and all the friends, and all the people, and I'd say, my God, have I lived. I owe nobody anything. I am free. What a wonderful time to know that all of the people you love know it because you've shown them and shared it with them and demonstrated your love. What a wonderful thing to say, lay there knowing full well that there's no if onlys, why didn't I? Oh God, I should have done. What a wonderful freedom. What a number, wonderful freedom. So my comment this evening is that yes, you can stay sober for good and for all. You will never have to drink again as long as you live if you don't want to. But there is more than putting the plug in a jug. Because the great promise to me, and it's the greatest promise I can offer to anybody. First of all, you'll never have to drink again as long as you live if you don't want to. But I can also say the biggest promise given to me is freedom. It's yours. As my sponsor says, there's enough freedom on that table in those books for all of us. So indulge yourself. And I look forward to meeting you further again as we trudge this happy road. Thank you.
I'd like to thank our readers.